Let us read in the Old Testament in the second book of Samuel, the 19th chapter, and reading from the midst of the 8th verse, which begins in the New International Version, begins a new paragraph. 2 Samuel 19 and 8b, David, who had been driven out of his palace and his city by his wicked son Absalom, who is now dead, returns to Jerusalem, and with all that is involved with that, and the many people who gathered on the eastern side of Jordan to meet him when he crossed the river on his way to Jerusalem. Meanwhile, the Israelites had fled to their homes. Throughout the tribes of Israel, the people were all arguing with one another, saying, "The king delivered us from the hand of our enemies. He is the one who rescued us from the hand of the Philistines. But now he has fled the country because of Absalom, and Absalom, whom we anointed to rule over us, has died in battle. So why do you say nothing about bringing the king back?" King David sent this message to Zadok and Abiathar the priests. "Ask the elders of Judah, why should you be the last to bring the king back to his palace, since what is being said throughout Israel has reached the king at his quarters? You are my brothers, my own flesh and blood," the tribe of Judah, of course. "So why should you be the last to bring the king back? And say to Amasa, a nephew of David, are you not my own flesh and blood? May God deal with me, be it ever so severely, if from now on you are not the commander of my army in place of Joab, who slew Absalom, you remember. He won over the hearts of all the people," that is, David did. "David won over the hearts of all the men of Judah as though they were one man. They sent word to the king, 'Return, you and all your men.' Then the king returned and went as far as the Jordan. Now the men of Judah had come to Gilgal to go out and meet the king and bring him across the Jordan. Shimei, son of Gera, the Benjamite from Bahurim, who cursed David on his flight, you remember, hurried down with the men of Judah to meet King David. With him were 1,000 Benjamites," he was a Benjamite, "along with Ziba, the steward of Saul's household, and his 15 sons and 20 servants. They rushed to the Jordan where the king was. They crossed at the ford to take the king's household over and to do whatever he wished. When Shimei, son of Gera, crossed the Jordan, he fell prostrate before the king and said to him, 'May my lord not hold me guilty. Do not remember how your servant did wrong on the day my lord the king left Jerusalem. May the king put it out of his mind, for I, your servant, know that I have sinned. But today I have come here as the first of the whole household of Joseph to come down," Benjamin, you see, his brother, "to come down and meet my lord the king." Then Abishai, son of Zeruiah, another of David's nephews, said, "Shouldn't Shimei be put to death for this? He cursed the Lord's anointed." David replied, "Here's the real David. What do you and I have in common, you sons of Zeruiah?" Zeruiah was David's half-sister. "This day you have become my adversaries. Should anyone be put to death in Israel today? Do I not know that today I am king of Israel? So the king said to Shimei, you shall not die. And the king promised him an oath. Here's another, Mephibosheth, Saul's grandson, also, of course, of the tribe of Benjamin, also went down to meet the king. He had not taken care of his feet, he was crippled, remember, or trimmed his moustache, or washed his clothes from the day the king left until the day he returned safely. When he came from Jerusalem to meet the king asked him, why did you not go with me, Mephibosheth? When he fled, he said, my lord the king, since I, your servant, am lame, I said, I will have my donkey saddled and will ride on it so that I can go with the king. But Ziba, my servant, betrayed me. Now notice this carefully. And he has slandered your servant to my lord the king. My lord the king is like an angel of God. So do whatever pleases you. All my grandfathers, his grandfather was Saul, of course, all my grandfather's descendants, Mephibosheth was the son of David's great friend, Jonathan, all my grandfather's descendants deserved nothing but death from my lord the king, but you gave your servant a place among those who sat at your table. So what right do I have to make any more appeals to the king? The king said to him, why say more? Now it was between these two, you see. One was blaming the other for Mephibosheth not running away with David. And the king said to him, notice the wisdom of the man. Why say more? I order you and Ziba, your servant, to divide your fields, your property. Mephibosheth said to the king, let him take everything now that my lord the king has arrived home safely. Now here's another section of the chapter. Barzillai, the Gileadite, on the eastern side of Jordan, also came down from Rogelim to cross the Jordan with the king and to send him on his way from there. Now Barzillai was a very old man, 80 years of age. He had provided for the king during his stay in Mahanaim, where he was hiding, for he was a very wealthy man. The king said to Barzillai, cross over with me and stay with me in Jerusalem, and I will provide for you. But Barzillai answered the king, how many more years shall I live that I should go up to Jerusalem with the king? I am now 80 years old, as if that was old. Can I tell the difference between what is good and what is not, dear me? Can your servant taste what he eats and drinks? Poor fellow, can I still hear the voices of men and women singers? Why should your servant be an added burden to my lord the king? Your servant will cross over the Jordan with the king for a short distance. But why should the king reward me in this way? Let your servant return, that I may die in my own town near the tomb of my father and mother. But here is your servant Kimham or Chimham, and many think this was a son of Barzillai. Some of the manuscripts say he was a son. Let him cross over with my lord the king. Do for him whatever pleases you. And the king said, Kimham shall cross over with me, and I will do for him whatever pleases you. And anything you desire from me, I will do for you. So all the people crossed the Jordan, and then the king crossed over. The king kissed Barzillai and gave him his blessing, and Barzillai returned to his home. When the king crossed over to Gilgal, Kimham crossed with him. All the troops of Judah and half the troops of Israel had taken the king over. Soon all the men of Israel were coming to the king and saying to him, "Why did our brothers, the men of Judah, steal the king away and bring him and his household across the Jordan together with all his men?" All the men of Judah answered the men of Israel, "We did this because the king is closely related to us, same tribe. Why are you angry about it? Have we eaten any of the king's provisions? Have we taken anything for ourselves?" Then the men of Israel answered the men of Judah, and this is rich. "We have 10 shares, 10 tribes, not counting Benjamin, of course, which is very close to Judah. We have 10 shares in the king. And besides, we have a greater claim on David than you have. So why do you treat us with contempt? Were we not the first to speak of bringing back our king?" But the men of Judah responded even more harshly, alas, than the men of Israel. What a fascinating chapter. May God bless his holy word to us. The Old Testament, the second book of Samuel, chapter 19, verses 9 to 43. We left off our reading last Sunday at the point when David accepted Joab's rebuke about languishing over his wicked son Absalom's death, and David got up to attend to the affairs of state, and first his victorious army. And the people in general were confused at the leadership crisis following the flight of David and then the death of the pretender Absalom. And so David expresses surprise that his own tribe of Judah were so slow to seek his return to his capital city of Jerusalem. But David appointed Amasa in place of Joab to be commander of the army, doubtless because of Joab's slaughter of Absalom. And so the men of Judah, having been challenged personally by the king, rallied to him as one man and called for him to return. And this, of course, David was glad to do, having received from them a unanimous invitation. And so he set out and got as far as the River Jordan. Meanwhile, the men of Judah hurried to Gilgal to meet the king when he crossed the river. And with them, surprise, surprise, that rascal Shimei, who cursed David on his retreat from the city, you remember. And with him, indeed, 1,000 Benjamites to plead mercy. And Ziba, his Mephibosheth's servant, also of the tribe of Benjamin, of course, who, you remember, had sent ample supplies to David on his flight. Now, these two men of Benjamin, Shimei, who cursed, and Ziba, who gave gifts to David, had opposite ideas about David's flight. The one cursing him, the other showering gifts on him in his distressed state. But they had apparently, since the king was returning, they had apparently made up their differences. They had better when David was returning to Jerusalem as king with power. And, of course, the malcontent, Absalom, was dead. That solved a very great deal, but not everything. So they all hurried to the ford of Jordan to meet the king. And who should be foremost to greet him but the horrid Shimei, flat on his face to express his repentance for cursing the king. But Abishai, David's nephew, said he should be put to death for cursing the Lord's anointed. But David said, no, I am king, and it is the king's prerogative to have mercy on sinners. Where did David learn that, do you think? I would say from the pre-incarnate Christ. He learned that 1,000 years before Christ was born and taught us to love our enemies. But who is this also meeting the king, cripple Mephibosheth? Jonathan's son, whom you remember David had invited to his stable, but who remained in Jerusalem when David was driven out, hoping, it was said, Ziba said, that he was hoping in the confusion that he might become king himself and restore his grandfather Saul's rule and reign, the reign of the tribe of Benjamin in Israel. That's what they said he had in mind, Mephibosheth had in mind. So David said to Mephibosheth, why did you not go with me when I had to flee, Mephibosheth? So he said, you know that I'm lame, and Ziba, my servant, betrayed me and slandered me to you. Well, who is David to believe? The cripple or his servant? If what Mephibosheth says is true, then Ziba, for all his generosity to David, had slandered his crippled master. But who is to be believed? In the circumstances, there's the wisdom of God from on high. David decided that Mephibosheth's lands should be divided equally between himself and his servant. But Mephibosheth said, oh, let him have them all as long as the king is back. And who shall say in that tangle how sincere that was? Although in the circumstances, you see, it would undoubtedly have been better for Mephibosheth to keep in with the king, especially if he was to be allowed to return to the king's table, you see. And so the story switches to Barzillai, the kind old man of Gilead who had lavished comforts on David in his flight. Chapter 17, 27, 29. Here, in the welter of confusion, and now that the king is on his way back, everyone jockeying for position, it is comforting to come upon a seemingly uncomplicated old man who simply wants to honor and bless the king. So Barzillai goes to see David across the Jordan, and David invites him to Jerusalem, where he says he will look after him. Oh, no, said Barzillai, I'm an old man. I will travel with you for a short distance, and then return home to my own place and people, and die there. But your servant, Chimham, who some manuscripts say was Barzillai's own son, he will go with you and do for you whatever you please. Oh, said David, I will do for him whatever you please, and I will do for you anything you desire. So you see, there was a wonderfully affectionate parting between David and Barzillai, the old man, after which the column moved off towards Jerusalem. Unfortunately, the chapter ends on a sour note, which is all to do with the alacrity, or the lack of alacrity, with which the various tribes sought to bring the king back to his capital. And you can understand the tension between them all, for all was confusion and disorder after the defeat of Absalom's side and his death, with David hiding away there on the eastern bank of the River Jordan. And the men of the other tribes of Israel were objecting to the men of Judah stealing away the king to take him back to the capital, as if they had no part in it. But, protested the men of Judah, we are more closely related to the king than you, because he is of our tribe, and we of his. Aha, but the men of Israel answered, we have 10 shares in Israel, leaving out the tribe of Benjamin, geographically and otherwise close to Judah. We have 10 shares in Israel, and in the king, and have therefore a greater claim on David than you. Why then, the men of the 10 asked, do you treat us with contempt? After all, it was we who were the first to speak of bringing the king back. So that's a rift we must leave, meantime, in this ongoing saga, and see in due course how it is resolved. But what a story! Who could keep up with its permutations through these chapters, eh? For how we view this long story and saga, and how we assess it thus far, will depend on the level at which we take it. What level are we going to take it at? Well, without harping on David's sin, I cannot help but go back to his youthful lapse which produced Absalom, and then the sin of his maturity which triggered off the avalanche of trouble that descended on him through Absalom and on the nation. But we must not be one-sided and see the course of this history mainly from the sinful point of view. Satan loves to get his oar in and would love us to be distracted to him. For what we see in the disorder following events is the devil's attempts at least to hinder the plans and purposes of God. But all to no avail, whatever temporary havoc Satan may cause amongst the Lord's people, he'll not prevail. He cannot, for God is sovereign. It is all in the Lord's sovereign will for his chosen people Israel, for whom he has everlasting purposes in view, although his true believing people, as recorded in his word, through the history and through the generations, sometimes only individuals, small groups, as patriarchs, kings, prophets in the Old Testament, and disciples and apostles in the New. I say, his true people for whom he has everlasting purposes are strewn as remnants throughout Israel's history, and will be until, as Paul shows in masterly fashion in his great 11th chapter of Romans, all the remnants of the true Israel, and after Christ, the remnants of the true Christian church, will be eventually gathered together as one body in Christ, one church of Christ. So, let us dwell on this elemental tension between good and evil as it works itself out in this present history. Admittedly, Israel wanted what God wanted, namely a king, but she wanted a king for the wrong reasons. And so her first king, Saul, was a disaster. Then their true King David came next, and despite his faults, which were many, writ large on the pages of biblical history because of his prominence, little people's sins are not so placarded, are they? Eh? But David next, despite his faults, writ large over the pages of history, David has shown himself in our readings in the books of Samuel to be a man of astonishing grace and forbearance, and even, like Christ, a lover of his enemies. 1,000 years before Jesus said that. Wonderful, wonderful. The influence of the pre-incarnate Jesus Christ, and his father, of course. At the same time, David, the dear man, pays for his every lapse. And you know, this at first may seem a strange thing. Think of this, that the Lord often seems to be harder on his own chosen people. Parents would understand this, wouldn't they? Eh? The Lord often seems to be harder on his own chosen people than on other sinners. But the reason is plain enough, if we look for it. His purposes for his own are absolutely at the other end of the spectrum from his purpose for those diametrically opposed to his purposes, whom eventually he will reject and cast out. Their heinous unbelief and wicked works can wait. Do you hear that? Their heinous and unbelief and wicked works can wait. God is patient to be dealt with in the appropriate, horrid place that we call hell and perdition. But since this earth, as our temporary home, is actually the veil, the manufactory of soul making, all our testings are here, since there will be no workrooms, no manufactory as such in glory. We won't be idle, but we won't be working in that sense. All will be exhibition and shop window, showroom. That's right. That's the great thing about our beloved brothers and sisters, like our late church officer James, who are now with Christ in glory. All the suffering is over, and there is nothing but bliss and glory ahead of them. For the degree to which we suffer down here for Christ's sake, not for any other sake, but for Christ's sake, is the degree to which we shall shine upstairs in glory. So, you see, here's a lesson. Don't miss this lesson. The saints have it in for them down here when they stray. Say that again. The saints have it in for them down here when they stray, because it is all for their refinement and eventual perfection. And indeed, God is not afraid to let his enemies... this is shocking. God is not afraid to let his enemies see him deliberately exposing his own children before the world for their sin. For he wants the world to see. Oh yes, he wants the world to see. If it has eyes, although it mainly hasn't, he wants the world to see what he is doing. And why? He is doing what he's doing if they can take it in. If we can take it in, eh? Why? Take an example. The whole world saw the wonderful work God did in rescuing his people Israel from Egypt after they had suffered for hundreds of years in the slavery of a heathen land, Egypt. After all, it was sin which drove them there, when you think of what happened to Joseph. But the Lord was equally open when they went astray in their own land. Equally open. Home, listen to this. Home, apparently, is the place where it is easiest to sin. The Lord was equally open when they went astray in their own land, and some wilderness or other, either Egypt or Babylon, or an apostate church in later years, may be the place where it is easiest to be good. Think of this. We bemoan the state of our national church. But the worse it is, the better it is possible for faithful Christians to be. You've an opportunity for sanctification and for holiness and for all that is good, because the church is in a bad state than if it was in a good one. Don't let's forget that. Yes. And so Israel, for her sins, had to be carried away into captivity and thrashed within an inch of her life by all these successive foreign emperors. You know, Assyria and Babylon and Greece and Persia and Rome and their false deities. So that the world saw that God was determined to produce a people purified by their sufferings for their sins. Say that again. He was determined to produce a people purified by their sufferings for their sins, and made pure and holy and good and true, so that the holy angels would see the finished product in heaven's glory in the showroom. And you see, this fully explains God's amazing ways with humanity, if we can see it. And I'm determined that we're going to see it. Perhaps, if I may say so, perhaps that's God's purpose in allowing this ministry to continue in the interests of future generations. I want these things to be known and to be handed down. And you know, although it is very kind of Rutherford House and dear David Searle to initiate the publication of what is called my collected works, 2 volumes of them down there, I think the content of what has been ministered here by word of mouth and by the printed word during these last 10 years since I ceased traveling the country is more penetrating and, I believe, more significant than what has been collected from addresses and studies given at student meetings and conferences from the 60s to the 80s. Perhaps I'm exaggerating the difference, since many of the earliest insights, in the booklet towards spiritual maturity, have proved, as Sinclair Ferguson said, having seminal seed thoughts, although some of these earliest insights are perhaps the brightest. I can honestly say that I'm seeing things now which I didn't see before, and I thank God for his kindness in allowing me to see them. And these are what I want to be preserved, and people to learn, and teach, and live by. Indeed, I would like very much to produce a book of these studies in David's life after we have finished 2 Samuel, under some such title as The Story of David, as being far more insightful than anything done in that area before. Therefore, you see, to see God's original purpose in allowing sin to come into the world, because he graciously desired to grant free will to his higher creatures, and while unrepented sin gets its own desert, repented sin is used to God's glory. And that's all very wonderful. God's original purpose, to allow sin, because he wanted to use evil for his glory. Not least today, because on every hand and at every level of society, there is such frantically naive inquiries going on into the meaning of life. And Andrew McKee down here has just handed me an article showing that there is a vast increase in the suicides of young people in our country today who have lost the way and find nothing worth living for, which is appalling. And every possible avenue is being sought and explored, but that one authentic orthodox one of Christianity, the gospel, Jesus Christ, he's the last one. The world and the media and the novels and the scholars will look at. Isn't that true? So, you see, this imposes on us. And I was speaking about how privileged we are to be together in prayer a moment ago. This imposes upon us the high responsibility of asserting and declaring the full story of the gospel and making known to any who will listen what God is about in the world today. And as suicides and murders, that was written before I got the article, as suicides and murders increase in the modern climate of complete bewilderment as to the meaning of life, it is ours to understand more than others do what God is about. We could go out into the world and stop people in Union Station and say, I know what God's doing in the world. How do you know? And you just need to brandish your Bible. Read that. And you'll know too. Isn't that it? Sorry, I lost my place. Yes. I'm saying here, that's why we cherish David and are so glad to see him on his way back to his palace in Jerusalem. And in the matter of Shimei, his cursor, showing mercy and dealing with these members of the tribe of Benjamin, set aside since Saul's failure to match up to being a worthy king of Israel. All these Benjamites, Mephibosheth, Ziba, Shimei, not forgetting Ishbosheth, you remember, who also aspired to the throne. And David shows mercy, dealing with them all so very justly and mercifully. So it is given to us with these insights. These are major insights this morning. And practical ones. Ones to live by and act out day by day. Neighbors and friends and fellow workers. Enemies, if we have any. Yes. Yes. I have seen in our midst this week a quality of grace that has touched me to the core. All the more because I know where it comes from. Comes from the book, and the book absorbed into our lifestyle and even our bloodstream. I say it is given to us with these insights to see grace working out its benevolent purposes in the midst of this wicked world. Now, this is what we've got to do. We've never to be completely preoccupied with the evil, however great and monstrous it is. We mustn't be preoccupied with it. We've never to forget Satan, but we've not to be preoccupied with him. Can you get that? Never forget him. Never be preoccupied with him. And yet, although we grieve at the sufferings which men inflict on themselves, Absalom, and on one another. We must not turn a hair as to what is going on in the world, because we know that a wise and wonderful God is in charge. Oh, believe that. Believe that fervently. Believe it in relation to your own personal, private life. Believe that in relation to your family and to your friends, neighbors, work fellows, everybody, members of the church. We know that a wise and wonderful God is in charge, and all will be well in the end. Oh, isn't it wonderful to have attained glory? Isn't it? All sorrow, sin, past. How wonderful. All will be well in the end. As this hymn says, with which we are to close our service. 702. Through the love of God our Savior, all will be well. Free and changeless is His favor. All is well. 702.